So could you just please give us an introduction of who you are?
I'm a law professor who teaches law at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law, and my areas of expertise are criminal law and procedure, defending battered women on trial, criminal procedure, and sexual assault law. I teach a course on that, and I also research and write in the area.
Okay, so you have an interest in...
Yeah, and I do a lot of research and writing in the area of battered women who've killed their husbands.
What interested you in the subject in the first place?
Well, in 1990, the Supreme Court of Canada released a landmark decision called the Lavallée case, mm-hmm. in which Lynn Lavallée was, her acquittal at trial was affirmed by the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Supreme Court of Canada allowed that the law of self-defense suffered from historical sex bias, and that to correct that sex bias, it was appropriate to allow the introduction of expert evidence on battered woman syndrome in order to inform the jury of the realities of battered women's experiences. So that decision was a decision that was recognized in countries around the world as a really progressive and important decision for women. And so since that time, I've been interested in following to see whether that decision has actually made a difference for women who are charged with murder of their husbands.
Right. You mentioned a sex bias. Can you explain that a little bit more, please?
Well, the law of self-defense is premised on a fight between male equals. You know, historically, the criminal law was designed by men for men. And so that means that when the drafters of the basic principles of the criminal code drafted those principles, they weren't thinking about women killing their husbands. In fact, you know, our earliest origins are that for women to kill their husbands was seen as a form of treason. It wasn't just murder. So the idea that a battered woman could have any right to kill in self-defense would have been quite contrary to the law at that time. Now we do have a gender-neutral law of self-defense, but it still is premised on a notion that, you know, it's two male adversaries of equal size and weight and, you know, capacity who fight it out, you know, who might find themselves in a sudden fight to the death. And, you know, the situation for battered women is quite different. They may live with ongoing violence. They certainly are in no way equipped for hand-to-hand combat with a male, and that means that they may need to kill while their adversary is asleep or passed out. It may mean that they need to use a weapon. It usually means women need to use a weapon to kill. So some of the usual principles of self-defense are unfair when applied to women. The idea that, for example, you can only kill in response to an imminent threat or a threat that's already in progress, that's going to be pretty impossible, because if a woman waits till a murderous attack is on her, she really won't be able to save her own life. And, the notion of proportionate force is not going to help women either, because they actually need weapons if they're going to overcome, you know, a man who's trying to strangle them or beat them to death.
Right.
So those are some of the sex biases that, you know, the law of self-defense has coded into it that mean that for women, they don't have a chance. Generally, they may not have a chance if you straightforwardly applied those rules to women.
Why is it that people have such a negative connotation when women have to use some kind of weapon to protect themselves? Like, why is that such a bad thing?
Well, I guess you must have noticed that there's a backlash against women and feminism. Right. So, you know, women using battered woman syndrome or other defenses that are intended to contextualize and demonstrate, you know, to a jury or a judge the biases against women, there's been a huge backlash against that. You know, lots of people call it, the abuse excuse, and, these women, they're all making things up, or they get breaks that men don't get, or women are violent too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess generally speaking, I'd say, A, there's a lot of backlash against women, and B, you know, in a patriarchal society, when women do make gains, for example, challenging, you know, men's authority in their homes to beat them or to control them or, you know, to stop them from leaving marriages, and then they get exonerated for using force when they defy that man's authority, of course there's going to be, you know, backlash against women in that context who've successfully argued, you don't have a right to control me. And in fact, if I need to kill you to escape or save my life, I will. It makes perfect sense that that's going to be the kind of case or exoneration that inflames the passions of people who really strongly believe that men have the right to run households, to use violence to keep women in line, etc.
Mm. You were also mentioning that you were writing a book about, I think, women's cases from 1990 to 2005?
Yes, I'm just finishing a book that examines the murder trial transcripts of women in that time period. So since Lavallee up until 2005, I'm looking at the murder trials of women who've killed allegedly violent men.
Have you seen any difference from the original 1990 case to any 2005 cases?
One unfortunate thing I notice is that the majority of women in these cases plead guilty to manslaughter rather than going on to a trial on the merits. So that means that they give up their right to argue self-defense in exchange for the certainty of a sentence that's less than life imprisonment. You know, if you go to trial for murder and you lose on your self-defense argument, there's no discretion for the judge. It's an automatic life sentence of imprisonment. And so for many women, particularly women who've been battered, you know, the prospect of being separated from their kids for that long is just too terrifying. So rather than go to court and argue their legitimate right to kill in self-defense, many, many women, the majority of women charged with homicide of their violent partners, will plead guilty to manslaughter and take a prison sentence in provincial reformatory, but lots of women also get federal sentences. And I have to say that the majority of those women who plead guilty and give up their trial rights are Aboriginal women. So we have a really serious problem that Aboriginal women are rarely go to court to contest their murder charges and overwhelmingly enter guilty pleas and don't go to trial. And that's a real problem because we already know that Aboriginal women are dramatically overrepresented in provincial institutions, but right now I think there's something like 72% of federally sentenced women, and it's quite a travesty when you consider how many of these women in fact lived and killed in extremely violent and terrifying circumstances. So it's quite tragic to think of the person then incarcerated, you know, for a federal sentence after all that, you know.
Yeah, why do you think women don't really exercise their right to argue for their own sentencing?
Well, one thing I've already mentioned is this idea that there's a mandatory life sentence if you fail at trial. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, life in prison is pretty scary to think about, especially if you're a mother of children, you know, and you know that you're going to lose those kids and you may never be able to contact them again, you know?
Do they just think that they're automatically going to lose?
Well, I think that for one thing, the challenges are different for Aboriginal women who, you know, where they may also face race stereotypes and racism in their trials, right? Like they may not have the same credibility as other women, you know, before a judge and jury. They may have backgrounds that make them not great witnesses. So, for example, if they have themselves been charged with violent offenses in the past, or if they have other sorts of, aspects of their background that will make them poor witnesses, then they may not actually, the assessment that they may not do well at trial might be correct, you know. It's also, you know, there are lawyers who, may not see the possibilities of successfully defending women. You know, I can imagine that sometimes it looks pretty daunting when, particularly because women often admit the facts. Women often acknowledge that they killed the man. So then the question is, you know, did you have a reason for doing it that we will accept as exculpatory. So I can imagine for lawyers, too, you know, it must be a bit challenging for them to sometimes figure out, okay, you know, do I have a good shot at getting this person acquitted? And the stakes are so high that it's a very tough decision, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Do battered women just have this kind of stigma around them where, like you mentioned earlier, people are kind of backlashing and they're saying women are just complaining about being abused and all this kind of thing? Why do you think that stigma exists?
I'm not sure if I would. I mean, what I would say is, well, as a society, we generally deny and minimize the violence that men commit against women. I'm not sure if I would say it's a stigma to be a battered woman. I guess it must be, but what I would say the overwhelming problem is that we deny it happens, or we say it's not that bad, or we say it's partly her fault anyway because she was drinking or she talked back to her husband or, you know, she didn't do the things he wanted her to do. You know, I think the real issue is that as a society we do not confront and denounce unequivocally male violence against women, and particularly male violence against female partners. I think that's the real issue.
Why do you think we don't address it?
For one thing, I think that male violence against women is deeply connected to women's inequality, social, political, economic inequality. To change male violence, that means we have to move towards a more substantively equal society. That's what we would need to do. If we were serious about eliminating male violence, we would have to change the kind of society we live in. And I think most people would rather deny we have a problem. And I think there are vested interests. Men get something out of using violence. Men get access to women's labor in the home. They get access to women's sexuality. They get access to women's money. They get access to emotional caregiving. They get a lot. They get stuff. So using violence is instrumental. Men use it to get women to dress the way they want them to dress, to cook what they want them to cook, to have the house in the order they want it, to make them give them their money, to make them, make the children behave, etc. So for one thing, that, you know, male violence is instrumental. For another thing, to stop it would mean we'd actually have to make men give up power, and we'd have to support women's equality unequivocally. And all the data tells us societies in which women enjoy more substantive equality, there's less violence against women. There's no question it's connected. So violence, male violence, is an issue of women's inequality. And as a society, I don't think at this point yet we're prepared to say it matters, you know, that women's inequality matters and that male violence matters enough that we're willing to confront what we need to confront to change it.
In your experiences as a professor and researching, have there been any cases or personal stories that really kind of jumped out at you?
There's a case that I'm profiling in my book of a woman, an Ottawa woman named Lillian Getcate, who was on trial for murder. And her case has touched me deeply, to read her case and to see what happened to her. She ended up getting convicted of manslaughter, and she got a compassionate sentence. So she was in the realm of, you know, women on trial. She was fairly lucky. She didn't get convicted of murder, and even though she did get convicted of manslaughter, she got a really good sentence. She basically got house arrest. But what happened after that was that there was a huge, huge media and public backlash against her. Just unbelievable the things people wrote and said about her. And really, the whole tenor of that was to suggest that she lied, that she wasn't a battered woman, that there was no evidence to support that she was battered or that she was in any danger. And then she got this, outrageous sentence when she should have been sent to prison. And the fact is, the one fact that was left out repeatedly by all that public commentary and media was the fact that there was a live explosive device in the woman's basement set to detonate. Unequivocal evidence that she lived in a violent home where death was imminent. And everyone in the media commentary left that important piece of evidence out. And it's one of those moments reading it, you think, wow, are we ever in denial as a society? We can go on and on and on about how outrageous it is this woman got house arrest, and when you and ignore the fact that she is lucky that her and her children were not blown to high heaven. The police officer who testified said it was a highly unstable device. And obviously, it had been her husband who'd rigged it up in their basement. So that's a story that touches me, and it's a story that tells me, you know, how much we as a society have invested in denying, you know, men's violence and denying women the right to use violence to free themselves and to save their lives or the lives of their children. So it's a story that tells me we have a long way to go still.
Just as a final note, is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
I guess, you know, my main message is that when it comes to male violence against women, you know, I've already said that it's deeply linked to women's inequality. But the other thing is, I would say, as a society, we actually need to take a position that we start by believing women when they tell us that they're in danger, that they're afraid, that something wrong is happening in their homes and in their lives, as opposed to denying and minimizing it. We ought to take the initial position that we believe women when they say that.
Thank you for calling in.